Somewhere out there. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
With our guest Gary Renard, we're going to talk about some past lives, some more predictions, and also the true identity of William Shakespeare. What, you might ask, pray tell? Shakespeare would write like that, wouldn't he? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Gary, first of all, why you? Why the Ascended Masters? Why would they visit you? Not the Pope or not some other people with a very stronger spiritual background?
Well, actually, that's a question that I asked them right from the beginning, and they said that they'd let me know eventually. And it turned out at the end of our conversations that I actually had a relationship with them that went back a long way. So this wasn't the first time that we were meeting. It turned out that I actually knew them in past lives. And so that was one of the reasons that they selected me. And another reason was just because I had enough time on my hands. I was working at home. It was a very quiet environment. And they knew that I would do the things that were necessary, not just to take down the information that they were presenting to me, but also I had the time to incorporate these teachings into my everyday life and integrate them into the way that I think so that I could forgive almost no matter what came up in front of my face on any given day.
Tell me about the past life relationship that you had with them.
Well, there were several, and I'm not going to give away the big one because that's a surprise at the end of the book. But I will say that we knew each other 2,000 years ago at the time of Jesus, and it turns out that we also knew each other in the future. So the lifetimes that we live actually all occur at once. As Einstein said, past, present, and future all occur simultaneously. And then what happens is the mind focuses on a certain place of space and time and cuts out everything else, kind of like walls it off in the mind. So it's like we're looking at a certain, you know, lifetime right now, but all of our other lifetimes are going on simultaneously. The idea of time is really something where it all occurred at once. But then we take it and we divide it up over and over and over again and subdivide it continuously so it looks like all these different times, past, present, and future, and we live it out in a linear experience, when in reality it really all happened all at once, including those past lives that we think about in the future lives.
Prior to their visitation to you, were you aware of any of your past lives?
Yes. Going back to the 1970s, that's when I really started to have mystical-type experiences. And by the 80s, I noticed that when I shut my eyes before I went to bed at night, even before I was asleep, I would start seeing all these images, kind of like movies, and sometimes even with sound. And I realized that what I was seeing were actually scenes from past lives, where I knew certain people that I also knew in this life. And they didn't look the same, but I knew intuitively who they were. So it was like I was actually being shown all these past lives that I had. And it was a progression where my mystical experiences were very visual. And I would see a lot of lights sometimes during the day, flashes of light. And I didn't really understand until later what they meant. But it turns out that it's just a symbol of the mind awakening and, you know, really, you know, becoming aware of what the truth is. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go finish.
Part of that truth is that it's a reversal. We think that things are being done to us. We think that things outside of us are doing things to us, when the truth is it's the other way around. We are actually projecting the things outward. And anything that is done to us is actually something that we're doing to ourselves. It just doesn't look that way. And the reason for it, as I said earlier, was so that we could see, you know, the things that are hidden in our unconscious mind as being outside of us. And that's kind of like an escape mechanism. It's a way of getting away from it. The only problem is it doesn't work. It keeps everything recycled and keeps it going. And you get this whole cycle of birth and death going. And the way out of it is through a certain kind of forgiveness that undoes the whole thing. So that's why it turns out that it's so important to forgive. It's not that you're forgiving other people. When you forgive people, you're actually releasing yourself. And that's where the quantum idea of everything being connected comes in. It turns out that when you forgive someone, you're the one who is actually benefiting, not them, because you were the one who was projecting them in the first place.
And the same is true, I guess, if you don't. If you present evil and hatred and things like that.
Sure. I mean, you know, I used to get upset when a certain politician would come on the TV, and that was getting me upset. And then one day I realized, you know, he doesn't even know that I'm watching. You know, so who's the one who's suffering here?
It's you.
Right. And then if you forgive, who's the one who's benefiting?
You.
That's right. And if you're benefiting, then what's that going to do for your health? You know, what's that going to do for your blood pressure?
Well, it'll de-stress you, that's for sure.
Sure. Can you put a price tag on something like that?
Endless.
Right.
Priceless.
And what's it going to do for your ability to think and solve problems?
Hey, I'll do the interview here, Gary. How many past lives do you think you had?
Well, I think that all of us live thousands of lives. And so, you know, we think that this one is really important because this is the one that we're focusing on, and we have this body identity, and we think that this is us, and it's all very fleeting and transitory. And we don't realize that it's such a long time, you know, the history of time and space, and we live thousands of lives. And so when you start looking at it that way, maybe you can start to take things a little less personally, and you can realize that there's something bigger going on and kind of like step outside of it and observe it so that you're not so stuck in it and so, you know, likely to react to things.
Do they give you a feeling, these masters, that even though we're going to have some bumps in the road, is this going to be a good life for us, or should we all start jumping right now?
Well, you know, that really varies wildly from person to person, and that's really part of that whole cycle of birth and death. And it's all meant to cover up the fact that even in the good life, you know, even if you're one of those people that has everything going right and you're very successful and you're getting famous and you have a lot of money, and you have a lot of success, and you know you have a good sex life, and you have all these things happening, you're still going to die. And everybody that you know is going to die, and there's going to be a lot of pain involved. And that's the good life. You know, and if that's the good life, then what's the bad life like? You know, what's the life like when you're born in Africa and you're starving to death and you have nothing? It's kind of like a realization that at some point people have to decide that this isn't home to them and that they want to, you know, go back to the source. And I promise you I won't start talking about oneness again.
Yeah, you do that and we got a great deal here. It's only that because I just didn't understand it.
I understand. But at some point I think that people like Buddha and Jesus decided that they wanted to go home, that they wanted to return to the source. And the way to do that, the fastest way to do that, is through this forgiveness of these images that seem to be outside of us, when they're actually projections of our own mind. Because when you do that, then you're actually undoing, you know, this idea of separation, which is the old subject and object kind of thing, and you're going back to a condition where there is no separation and where everything is connected, and then you can begin to expand and fill that space to the point where you eventually transcend it and return home. So when the Buddhists, you know, teach non-judgment, and when Jesus was able to forgive people even when they were killing him, it was kind of like an uncompromising brand of forgiveness that said that there's nothing in this world that can affect me if my identity is not that of the body, but is actually, you know, the identity where I came from, which is spirit, which is perfect and immortal and invulnerable and something that can't really be affected by anything in this world. So it's a totally different way of looking at life, and it's returning to a totally different life form, kind of like a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. It's going from a restricted form of life to an unlimited kind of spirit life.
The masters talked to you a little bit about William Shakespeare. How did his name even come up with this?
Well, you know, it was interesting. We were talking about a wide variety of subjects, and I had quoted Shakespeare or something. I wrote this little poem that was kind of a takeoff on Shakespeare, and for some reason we started talking about him. And they said that the actual William Shakespeare was named Edward de Vere, and he was the 17th Earl of Oxford, and that Queen Elizabeth I at that time prevented him from putting his name on his work. She didn't actually stop him from writing, but at that time, writing would have been beneath the dignity of royalty, especially comedies and things like that. It would have been something that wouldn't have been acceptable to the queen. She was a very, very strong-willed person and very controlling. And so she didn't stop Edward de Vere from writing, but she did prevent him from ever saying that he was the one who wrote these works. Now, de Vere, his family crest, as it turned out, is a picture of a lion shaking a spear. And he was toasted at the royal court with this phrase by people, "Your countenance shakes a spear." So that was their way of toasting him at court. So there was kind of an identification with this idea of shaking a spear. And when Edward de Vere found out that there was an actor named William Shakespeare, then he thought that was really cool, because now, you know, if he had this actor take the plays and present them as though it was actually the actor that wrote them, and with the name Shakespeare, it was kind of a sly way for him to take some credit for his work and have a little bit of a buzz going about him really being the one that wrote the plays. And so he hired this actor named William Shakespeare to say that he wrote the plays and present the plays in public, and that's how his work actually got presented to the public. And not only that, but most of the plays were actually published after the actor named William Shakespeare died.
So that guy that we've seen in all these illustrations, that's the actor?
Right. He had nothing to do with actually writing the plays. He was an actor who took credit for the plays for a rather small sum of money.
Pretty good actor, too, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very good. And he also played the part of being the writer very well. And I guess he didn't mind taking credit for such great work. But most of those plays are actually published as a catalog after the actor died. And probably the most interesting thing for me was that there's this scholar that I've met since the book came out. His name's Richard Smalley. And he read that part in the book about Edward de Vere. And when he was in England, he thought that what I wrote in the book was so interesting and what the master said that he actually went and looked up the personal Bible of Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford. And what he found was that the parts in the Bible that were underlined were the very same parts that William Shakespeare used in his writing, that those were the parts that he quoted from the Bible in his plays and stuff like that. And so the scholar Smalley thought that was a really interesting piece of evidence, that Edward de Vere would have underlined all these parts in his own Bible, and it turns out that those are the exact quotes from the Bible that Shakespeare used in all of his plays. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Give me another glimpse of the future. They say anything about asteroids or anything like that?
No, they don't see any big calamities like that. You know, a lot of people are calling for terrible things to happen, like there's a lot of predictions that because the Mayan calendar ended in the year 2012, that that's when life is going to end on Earth and there's going to be these terrible things happening. And my teacher said, no, that's not going to happen. The reason that the Mayan calendar ends in 2012 is because the Mayan civilization collapsed, and so they stopped making the calendars. And so, they don't really see any major calamities in this century. They just see a lot of good and a lot of bad, continuation of terrorism, that great economic expansion. And it's really all a condition of where, you know, there's this illusion of things getting better. But if the more things change, the more they stay the same. And when you think about it, you know, you cure one disease, and what happens? Another one pops up. There's like this illusion of progress going on. But what it really is a smokescreen to make people think that things are getting better. And the reason for it, once again, is to keep people's attention diverted out there on the screen where the answer isn't, instead of keeping their attention on the mind, which is where that decision to forgive is. If the illusion can keep people reacting to what seems to be outside of them, then that's what keeps the whole system going in the first place.
You know, you had mentioned, and one of our previous guests, Glenn Kimball, has mentioned the Nag Hammadi as well. Why or how was this Gospel of Thomas, one of those ascended masters who visited you, why was it so different from what the other texts of the Bible were?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think the first thing is that we're presented with a Jesus in this Gospel, the Gospel of Thomas, who is not presenting himself as being like God's only begotten Son. He's not presenting himself as being different or special or better than anybody else. He's actually kind of like leading people by example. He's saying, look, you know, it's not just me. You can be like me. You know, you can have the same incredible experience of being with God and what that's like as I'm having. And the way to do that is in changing the way that you look at other people. And that's really the key. Because, you know, I always went through life thinking it was very important how people looked at me. You know, I thought that if I could get people to look at me in a certain way, if I could be successful, if I could make a lot of money, then, you know, I could get the world to look up to me, and somehow I thought that that would make me feel good. But it doesn't really work.
No,
I mean,
it doesn't.
If being famous and being successful made people happy, then Elvis would have been like the happiest guy.
If you don't have the character to start with, Gary, nothing, money, riches, fame, nothing works for you.
Right. And so I thought that it was very important, you know, how people looked at me. And it turns out that how we experience ourselves and how we feel about ourselves is not determined by how people look at us. How we will feel and experience ourselves is really determined by how we look at them. And that's just the opposite of the way that most of the world thinks.
Well, then, now, Thomas, of course, was with Jesus, as were the other apostles who wrote their version. Why was his so different from theirs?
His was so different was because it was the original, and it was right there at the time of Jesus. And Christianity is not actually based on the teachings of Jesus. Christianity is actually based on the theology of the Apostle Paul, who was not there at the time of Jesus. He doesn't come along until, 20, 30 years later. Then you have the theology of Paul is expressed in these letters that were written to all these people, and we think that, they're, just something that is part of the Bible, and it appears, after these Gospels that we get at the beginning of the Bible. But actually, that's the basis of Christianity, because they came before the Gospels that are presented as the mainstream Gospels in the New Testament. So you have the Gospel of Thomas, then maybe 20, 30 years later, you have the letters of Paul, and then it's not until maybe 40, maybe 70 A.D., 40 years after Paul, that you have the first of these Gospels appear that we now think of as being the mainstream Gospels. Those Gospels had stories in them. The Gospel of Thomas and the earliest Gospels were called sayings Gospels because they didn't have any stories in them. They were just listings of these things that Jesus actually said. And it wasn't until much later, that you have these stories that have been developed by this now-developing religion, which some people are getting zealous about, and they pass these stories down a couple of generations. And then from 70 A.D. to 120 A.D., you have the first versions of what we now think of as being the four mainstream Gospels. But those are coming as much as 120 years after Jesus, and by then they didn't really bear too much of a resemblance to what Jesus was talking about in the Gospel of Thomas. So eventually you have a religion that's developing, and instead of being like Jesus, which is about giving power to the individual and salvation to the individual, it's about giving power to the church. And so you have an institution developing that is designed to give power to those, who are running the church instead of what Jesus is all about, which is giving individual spiritual power to the people by following his example.
When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about this transportation that you were sent on. You went to a city, some 30 miles away instantly?
That's right.
All right, you have to tell us how that happened. By the way, the disappearance of the universe, where do you get it?
The disappearance of the universe is available at virtually every bookstore in America. It made number one in religion and spirituality at Amazon.com. And it's doing very well. I'm very excited. You can get it at any store, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and you can also get it at Hay House, which is my publisher. But probably the fastest way to get it is just go to my website, which is GaryRenard.com.
R-E-N-A-R-D.
That's right.
Simple as that. Toll-free number, by the way, also?
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me.
Oh, I do.
Great.
800-654-5126. It's extension 102. 800-654-5126 if you're interested in the disappearance of the universe. Well, we'll be back in a moment with Gary Renard. We're going to disappear for just a few minutes, and then we will be right back, right here on Coast to Coast AM. So
the official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now. Talk with George Norrie. Call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
If you are a StreamLink member, don't forget we've got our monthly chat tomorrow. I'll be there for a full hour for you, beginning at 8 o'clock Pacific Time, 11 o'clock Eastern Time. That's at night now, right here on Coast to Coast AM for StreamLink members. Gary, did the Bible Code ever come up with these masters?
Actually, I'm not that familiar with the Bible Code, so I couldn't tell you that. But I don't think so.
So there's no hidden messages in the Bible, I guess.
Well, there could be mathematical messages. There are all kinds of fascinating things in this universe. And I think that ultimately what my teachers were saying, that no matter how interesting it is, that anything that is separate and can be perceived is not reality. So it turns out that, you know, the Buddhists and the Hindus were right when they said that the world is an illusion. However, that teaching by itself is not really enough It's just one piece of the puzzle. It's just part of the picture. And all that would do would be to depress people if you just keep telling them that the world is an illusion. What you have to do is give them something better. You have to give them a choice that's better than this world. And that choice that is better is an experience of your source. And that experience is one that is so full and whole and complete that once you have that experience, it just blows away, you know, anything that this world has to offer. And that's the experience that I think the Course in Miracles is directed towards, and that the disappearance of the universe is directed towards. It's meant to give people, through, you know, the application of these ideas, an actual spiritual experience. And it's that experience that is the real answer, not so much intellectual concepts or ideas, but, you know, through application, the actual experience of what you really are. And that experience is kind of like, you know, after that, everything here is kind of like chicken crap compared to the real deal, you know, compared to, you know, reality, then something where something is missing because it's not full and complete just won't suffice anymore, because you realize that you're actually getting something better than what's available in this world. And I think that's part of what Jesus and Buddha were teaching, that salvation involved, you know, going up to a higher form of life.
Tell us about this transporting of you. What happened?
Well, you know, that was wild. I was at home. It was a summer day. I think it was August, and it was kind of hot. And I had a visit from Arden and Bursa. And as soon as they showed up, and I should point out that, you know, when they appeared instantaneously. It was almost like flicking the remote on a TV screen. You know, there was no delay or anything. They just appeared instantaneously and started talking. There were no, like, glowing colors or ceremonies or any of that stuff. And it was also true when they disappeared. They would just disappear instantly. And once again, it was like flicking the remote on a TV screen. And they appeared one day, and the first thing that Arden said to me was, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Ready for what?" And then instantaneously, they transported me through what they called mind transport to a city 30 miles away from where we were. We were in Poland Spring, Maine, and they transported me to Portland, Maine, which is the biggest city in Maine, not that it's that big. And I recognized it right away because I'd walked in the city a few times before that. And we were sitting on these steps, and it just completely blew my mind. And what they were trying to teach me with that was that everything that we see is a projection of the mind, and that once you gain that power of the unconscious mind, that you could literally go anywhere that you want to. And we got up and we started walking through Portland, and we were there for a little while and we talked. And they just wanted to give me a sense of that power of the mind and how it's possible to actually, you know, transport yourself, because everything that we are seeing is actually a projection that is coming from the unconscious mind. And that's a very important concept when it comes to other psychic phenomena and, you know, things like remote viewing, which is actually a projection of the mind.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And, so yeah. You were not there physically. People didn't see you.
Yes, they did.
Oh, they did.
I was there physically. One thing I want to point out about Arden and Persa was that they were just as real as any bodies that I've ever seen.
These are the masters who came to you.
Right. In fact, Persa, the beautiful woman, actually let me touch her once. I asked her if I could, and you know, because I wanted to see, you know, if she felt real, not just looked real.
Well, I mean, you touched her arm or something?
That's right. She wouldn't let me.
Think she would.
Yeah. And so, you know, they were just as real as anybody else. And what they were saying was that these bodies that seem so real are also kind of like part of this holographic you know, movie that we've made up that's multi-sensual, and, you know, it seems very, very real. But the truth is that you can mimic that nowadays even with machines. I mean, there's a machine in a lab at MIT that you can put your hand in and feel things that aren't there. You know, so the technology exists to actually feel things that aren't there, see things that aren't there, and that's very much what's going on, according to them, in this illusion, which is actually like a dream that we're going to awaken from when we return to this higher life form.
Let's take a few calls for you. You ready?
Sure.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is John from Oklahoma City.
Hi, John.
I just had a couple of questions about drugs like acid and marijuana. I was just wondering if the guest may have used anything like that to enlighten his mind, to kind of open up channels to new ways of thinking.
Okay, I believe you said at the outset, Gary, that you did not have any mind or mood-altering drugs. Is that true?
Yeah, I said that I wasn't under any form of medication. Actually, if you go back to the 1970s, I did drink and I did smoke some grass back in the 70s. And that was about it, really. And through all the 80s, I was sober. And by the time I got to Maine in the 90s, it's been a long time since I even smoked any grass. And I certainly never did any acid or anything like that.
So it wasn't anything like maybe shrooms that caused the visions?
No, definitely not. In fact, I had been having a history of mystical-type experiences that were very visual. Going back about, 15 years, I'd say to about 1978 when I did a thing called the Yes Training. That's really when I sobered up and got into spirituality and metaphysics. And so this was kind of like the culmination of a long series of mystical experiences that were very visual that I had been having. And I don't think that, any drugs had anything to do with it.
Okay, I find this very interesting. I only have one more question. Do you think it was possible that this couple that visited you, these ascended masters, that they may have actually been aliens?
Well, I don't think so. But the thing is to remember, and they said that aliens that visit the Earth, that we should think of them as being our brothers and sisters, because the humanoid life forms that visit Earth are really in the same boat that we are. Some of them may be, more technologically advanced than us, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're more spiritually advanced than us. And then, perhaps other ones are. So there's quite a variation in the different life forms that visit us. And they said that extraterrestrials do come here, and they do visit us. But there's a wide variety of explanations for that. And as far as they personally are concerned, their past lives and future lives involved life on this planet. And so I would say that they definitely were not extraterrestrials in that sense.
All right, thanks for that call. Next up, first-time caller line. Where are you calling from? Hi there.
How you doing? My name's Sean. I'm calling from Quincy, Massachusetts.
Fine, Sean.
First-time caller. I was wondering if you were familiar with Dr. Brian Weiss, author of Many Lives, Many Masters.
Regular guest on the program, I am. How about you, Gary?
Well, I've heard of Dr. Weiss, and I've heard some very good things about him. I haven't read his book, but he shouldn't feel bad about that, because I really don't read very much.
And, I've only read two of his books. Sorry to interrupt, but he talks a lot about, hypnotize some of his patients, psychologists, and he was getting masters speaking through them to him directly.
Sure.
And they said to him that we're basically here on this planet to test our faith, and that we develop our souls to higher and higher levels, and we actually end up choosing to come back or not. And I was wondering if there was any relation, any familiarity with him to your experiences as far as recreation. Do we come back as animals and stuff like that?
Well, I can't speak for Dr. Weiss, but I would say that usually a human comes back as a human, mainly because there's kind of like a pattern of lessons to be learned. But that's not really important because, as my teachers explained, and it's very much like the Buddhist teaching, that mind is mind, and it doesn't really matter what the container appears to be. So mind will occupy a certain body, like an animal in one case, a human being in another case. And even in the case of humans, one human will appear to be much more intelligent than another. And then humans will appear to be much more intelligent than an animal. But the truth is that's all illusion, that once you get back to the level of mind and leave the body, then it's all the same. So the illusion is simply meant to trick us into having this body identification and thinking that one body is more important than another body. That way you have levels and you have comparisons and you have all these things that occupy our attention, when the truth is that's not what matters. What really matters is eventually coming to this form of forgiveness that they kept teaching me over and over again.
Gary, are you able to replicate the transportation experience that you had?
Well, I've had a little bit of success with that. I haven't gone all the way to the level of my teachers yet. And they told me that actually I have one more lifetime to live after this one. So I think that the purpose of this lifetime for me is to develop fast and to have a great deal of progress. And then the next lifetime for me will be kind of like a summing up process where I just have a couple more lessons to learn, and that'll be the end. And I think that, that's okay with me. I don't mind coming back once more because they told me a little bit about it, and it sounded like a pretty interesting lifetime.
Do you believe that these reincarnated lives are back-to-back, or is there a gap in terms of our kinds of perception of time, a number of years?
Well, you know, that's interesting because it can vary. It's possible to have your next lifetime be linear and back-to-back, but it would also be possible to go backwards, you know, in time. You could go back 300 years, and your next lifetime, so to speak, you know, could be in the 1600s. So there's no reason in a holographic model why your next lifetime would have to be, you know, in a linear time frame where you would have to come back and, you know, have your next lifetime be 40 years from now. It just so happens that in my case, my next lifetime is in the future, but that's not mandatory. That's not something that has to happen that way.
All right, next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Nando?
Hi, Nando. Go ahead.
I'm calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a few questions. One is I want to know if the Ascended Masters that he has been making contact with has made any reference to the Ascended Master Saint Germain. And my second question is if he has, if they've also talked to him about the religion, the I Am.
Actually, no. My teachers have not mentioned Saint Germain. Now, since the book came out, I've heard of Saint Germain, and actually a lot of people have told me about him. I didn't realize at the time that they were visiting me that there were other Ascended Masters. I really didn't know very much about them. But since the book came out, a lot of people have written to me and told me about different Ascended Masters, including Saint Germain. I'm not familiar with the I Am religion, and so I haven't asked them about it, and I really can't comment on that, except to say that as far as I know, aside from Artin and Persa, Saint Germain is, as far as I can see, the most famous of the Ascended Master teachers, and there are a lot of people who are familiar with him.
Well, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. It's your turn. Hi there.
Aloha. Aloha, George.
Hi,
aloha,
there.
Gary. Excuse me. This is Kala calling from the most remote spot on Earth, the island of Maui. And I hope I have a couple of germane comments to make and a question. What you're talking about, Gary, sounds a lot like epiphenomenalism, which is the philosophical belief that what we think of as reality is all an illusion, dream, imagination, idea, thought, while what's really going on is the electrochemical, whatever, reactions, interactions taking place entirely within the brain. But if all of these things that we see and do are really projections, as your analogy was, from within the brain, then such things as migrations from Mars and machines left behind on the moon and so forth, I find it difficult to see what relativity that has. And if we're all experiencing the same thing, it sounds a lot like mass hallucination.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. In a way, it is a mass hallucination because it's all coming not from separate minds, but from one mind. It's actually emanating from one unconscious mind, or, you know, the way Jung put it was the collective unconscious. And so the Buddhists were actually right when they said that there's only one ego appearing as many. So there's only one of us that thinks that it's here. And then we look out with the conscious mind and we see all these separate bodies and all these seeming separate identities. But that's what the Hindus would call the world of multiplicity. So the illusion is that you have all these different bodies and brains, when the truth is that there's only one of us that thinks that it's here once you get down to that level of the unconscious mind. Now, the projections that we're seeing are not coming from the brain. The brain itself is a projection, which is coming from the unconscious mind. So it turns out that the brain is really just a part of the body, but we want to think it's a very important part of the body, and that's just another trick to make the body seem special and real when it's just this projection that's coming from the unconscious mind.
Well, William Blake said the only thing that's real is imagination. I know you don't believe in coincidences, George.
No, not at all.
I believe in synchronicities myself. I happen to know Wayne Dyer. I had taken the love of my life, a 95-year-old woman, named Alceta Sterling, who had just published her first book of poetry, a direct descendant of three signers of the Declaration of Independence. And Wayne was having a book coming out party for her. And I had gone out into the yard to have a smoke and stand on the beach. He came around the corner and, seeing someone he didn't recognize, approached me in a way that I assure you had nothing to do with absolute love or total forgiveness. It reminded me more of like a Doberman. But in any case, I'm trying to think of the name of the movie where a fellow took mushrooms and went into an isolation tank. George, help me here.
Oh, I'll tell you what. Someone will fast blast me that, and I'll put it on for you.
Okay, well, that actually was based on a real event. The fellow who went into the tank was John Lilly, who I also know or knew. I tried to get through when Joan Ocean was on the other night and talking about
dolphins.
John Lilly and mentioned the aliens and porpoises and whether there was any connection there. And that brings up Stitchin's idea that his gods, in quotes, were amphibious beings that lived underwater at night. They always went back underwater to sleep.
Some of them did, not all of them. We're already approaching the hour. The name of this book, of course, is called The Disappearance of the Universe by our guest, Gary Renard. It's available, of course, Amazon.com, or as he said, most major bookstores as well. Here's a toll-free phone number for you, 800-654-5126. And his website, Gary Renard, renard.com. His story, basically, it's fascinating. And like he said, you're going to love it or you're going to hate it. But it has to do with two mysterious people who came to him, ascended masters, as he calls them, that revealed some of the secrets of existence that you've heard tonight right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'll come back in a moment with you on Coast to Coast. Don't go away.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.